bastones pintados con palos de ensueño, de engaño y de amor. La vida es un mazo marcado, baraja los naipes, la mano de Dios. Las malas que embosca la villa se dieron en juego en cada ilusión. Y así fue robándome fichas la carta negada de tu corazón. Hagan juego, monte criollo, que en su emboque tu ternura palpite. Hagan juego, me mandé mi resto en cope.
Out the club about three to the takeaway. The shit in a tray merchants. Shop's got a special perchant for the disorderly. Geezers looking ordinary and a few looking leery. Chips fly round to the sound of the latest chart entry. An incendiary waiting to blast. No arm with a contest, who can throw the furthest?
Y después de los tres toques con tu olvido, me topé. Perdí los primeros convites, parando en carpetas de suerte y verdad. Y luego buscando desquite, cien contras seguidas, me dio tu maldad. Me ofrece la espada su filo, rencores del vasto, te quieren vengar. Hoy juego mi trampa tranquilo, y entre oros y copas, te habré de olvidar. Hagan juego, monte criollo, que en su emboque tu ternura palpite. Hagan juego, me mandé mi resto en cope, y después de los tres toques con tu olvido, me topé.
I can feel the talisman in my pocket. It's slippery in an unpleasant way.
Good evening, dear listeners, and welcome again to Symposium. Tonight's lecture could be a tango about misfortune and the intricate efforts that lead humans to search for palliatives in the form of little conceptual objects, humble or precious, visible or invisible. Amulets, talismans, and charms are among those conceptual objects. Nothing distinguishes an amuletic stone from an ordinary one, only the narratives bringing it into someone's hand or pocket. It is not a matter of color or shape, and in fact, I am right now looking at a very curious small cubic stone, a pyrite, with an irregular triangle carved out of one of its sides that is sitting on my windowsill. It is almost yellow, almost colorless, a metal. I keep it as an amulet of thought that I use to protect myself from superstition. In fact, I have oftentimes wondered whether criticism is but the systematic oblivion of the fetishist norm, and I've also wondered if superstition is not the very threshold of philosophy, and philosophy its replacement, or its Aufhebung, to put it in Hegelian terms. Is there a more sophisticated technique of self-management of misfortune? I am using Eric Edwards' phrase, as his will be our guest voice this evening. His lecture, The Self-Management of Misfortune by Use of Amulets and Charms, was given at the University of Oxford's Ethnicity and Identity Seminar on February 3rd, 2012. Mr. Edwards, a scholar from the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, has kindly given us permission to broadcast his lecture on our program tonight. Our transmission is made thanks to Oxford University's podcasting service that I would also like to acknowledge. As usual at Symposium, we aim to provide access to things hidden in plain sight and critical mediation to archival overabundance. We run against time and the times. Besides, and since we are fond of all sorts of intermissions, we will listen to Eric Edwards' originally seamless talk in two parts. Mr. Edwards' paper is itself composed of four sections, the first two focusing on general aspects of amulets and charms and their status as objects, and the following sections addressing the use and circulation of those objects in ancient and medieval Europe, and in the modern times, the city and museums of London. Listening to this evening's lecture, you will notice the presence of a slideshow somewhere near the keynote speaker. You may take the words as slides for the capricious amulets to glitter in front of you.
Well, the title of this talk is Self-Management of Misfortune and Belief in the Efficacy of Protective Amulets and Charms, which should indicate that because it's such a vast subject, I've concentrated on those amulets and charms which do with illness and things like that. And I divided it up into several subheadings. First part is the law of charms and medical folklore, which is sort of an introduction. Then I go on to amulets and charms as such, and I'll follow that with information about amulets and charms in London museums, followed by amulets and charms in Britain generally, and also, I'm not going to forget it, amulets and charms in the Pitt Rivers Museum. And then there's a very short conclusion. Well, the wearing of charms to ward off ill luck or evil spirits, it did in fact begin. They began as adornments millennia ago at the dawn of human history. African evidence that we have, which is some 75,000 years, shows that shells were used for adornment. In Paleolithic Germany, mammoth tusks, we know, were intricately carved and engraved into charms or talismans of around about 30,000 years before the present. Prehistoric amulets were made from shells, animal bones, fossils, or even fashioned from clay. But later amulets became made from wood, stone, rocks, and eventually precious gems. Ancient Egyptian amulets were worn mainly as identification, but potentially sometimes as totemic items. They were also used as symbols of belief and good luck, as well as prophylactics for good health and to fend off illness. During the Roman Empire, tiny emblematic fish charms were secreted within the clothing of Christian individuals, and in Judaic lore, tiny inscribed passages inside amulets were worn near the heart. Well, figure one here is the Egyptian example, Egyptian amulets, and you can see it. Figure 44 there is a frog. That's used as a symbol for the god Ptah, I mentioned later. But it represents life as embryo and is worn for recovery from disease. 46 is a pillow. That's used for preservation from sickness and against pain. And 51, the vulture, is there to protect from scorpion bites. The other two are Gnostic symbols, which are also used, worn as amulets for health. Next one, this is just examples of Etruscan, Greek, Roman and Oriental talismans, which, as you can see, represent different things. And the next one is an example of the Jewish amulet, which I mentioned just now. Amulets, therefore, appeared throughout history, they're not a recent innovation, and across many cultures and in an infinite variety of forms. Charms were worn in the belief that they obtained favour for their wearers. Many amulets were seen as protective against the evil eye. Wearing amulets and charms, often in the forms of beads made from gold, silver, bronze, coral or clam and cowrie shells, played an important role against the evil eye. If you've got figure four, this is a selection of amulets and charms. I think they are mainly from the Wellcome collection, but they show a great variety of and there are some charms that there are amongst people. But also I'd like to say that charms and amulets are not just simply specimens of folklore. What is needed to understand is that the belief is crucial to an understanding of this superstition. Well, magical remedies, rituals and explanations were passed down by word of mouth from one generation to the next, either as folk tales or as a religious discourse. And the effect of oral transmission of belief, and I think we all still realise this, persists even after the original reason for the belief has long ceased to exist. So the theory of sympathetic magic and similarity and contagion originated with the works of Sir James George Frazer. Being an ex-library assistant in the 2 years, I couldn't avoid reading his books. Frazer argued that magic is based on two principles. First, that like produces like, or that an effect resembles its cause, and Frazer called this the law of similarity. In other words, the magician is inferring that he can produce an effect by imitating. Secondly, things which have once been in contact with each other continue to act each other, and Frazer called this the law of contagion. Therefore, the magician is affecting an object, and the person who is in contact with the object is also being affected. Therefore, early healing was supposedly obtainable by what is, can be seen really as homeopathic principles that like cures like. So the sympathetic magic, or the law of sympathy, can be subdivided into two branches, which becomes obvious. Firstly, the homeopathic magic, or the law of similarity, and secondly, contagious magic, or the law of contact. Charms are based on the law of contact or contagion. They can be described as contagious magic. Magic based on creating the illusion of creating reality, and by doing so, the magician believes he's actually doing this, he can actually control external reality. So amulets and charms represent, in truth, an appreciation and the practice of personal, sympathetic or homeopathic magic by an individual. Superstition is an irrational belief in luck, omens, spells or supernatural powers. And we all realise that from time immemorial, people throughout the world have had this mystic reverence for the so-called unknowable. So the study of amulets and charms, it means that we've got to investigate their special connections with particular cultures. So an amulet, it's got a specific purpose because it is worn to benefit from its magical properties. The most interesting feature of superstition is the remarkable array of objects associated with magic by folk all over the world. So charms and amulets, what they're really doing is internalising a magic that embraces the belief that the external world can be changed by man's subjective attitude to it. Now, folk medicine is really a comprehension of charms, incantations, traditional habits and customs relative to preservation of health and the cure of disease. Therefore, prophylactic, amuletic folk remedies have received, because of this, actually much less attention than curative treatment itself. So medical folklore flourished alongside and overlapped with medical quackery. Now, the derivation of quackery is quite interesting. It's from the farmyard, literally, because those who were called quacks were called so because they resembled ducks, in the sense that farmyard ducks, because medical quacks advertise noisily with strident exclamations their wares and their ability to deal with disease. So quackery flourished, therefore, in the absence of doctors and treatment and medical advice. Quackery, therefore, found a niche when ailments were offensive, repugnant or untreatable by physicians. So what did people do? They turned to homeopathic magic and superstition, and by resorting to magic in preference to science and medical opinion, this indicated that they had a hope that they would find a way out of a medical problem. But amulets are similar to talismans. And the word comes from the talisman. The word comes from the Arabic tilazim, or tilazim, the intention to bring good luck and protection to the wearer. In the mid-15th century, the term amulet, or amulethis, came from the Latin amuletum, probably related to a word amuleri, which means to avert, to carry away, to remove. Therefore, the earliest meaning of the word is found in the natural history of Pliny the Elder. It was not recorded, the word was not recorded in English until 1600, and it wasn't known in Middle French until between 1595 and 1605, when it was called amulet. So an amulet can be traced to Arabic hamala, which means to carry. Talisman is from the Arabic tilazm, the Greek telesma, which means payment, or Greek telie, which means to complete or to perform. In other words, what is in being implied is an initiation into a mystery, and therefore it is also used as a synonym for amulet. And most amulets are objects of common origin, and as I've said just now, they can show considerable variation. They are also objects used by ordinary people as protective charms. It can be any object that has been assigned a magical function by a single person, and it can be an object that has a meaning recognised by most peoples of a culture. It mattered not how it lacked in sophistication, the essential point was its magical power. The magic of these prophylactic charms was inherently linked to their physical presence. An amulet, therefore, is anything worn as a charm against evil, disease, or witchcraft. And as I've tried to say before, the worldliness of an amulet is in fact its meaning. As objects, they also possess a commonality. They can confer protection by causing harm, by conferring upon the possessor the ability to resist magic, disease, death, or misfortune. Amulets can also protect people and property against assumed evil by causing injury or harm to opponents, threats, or malign spirits. Therefore, these varying amulet types confer protection against different evils, and this protection is dictated by the needs of the owner of the amulet, the wearer of the amulet. They confer protection by their presence and retain potency as long as the wearer retains his trust in it, his or her trust in it. Therefore, the validation of amulets and charms is that people who may wear them believe in them. For these artifacts are examples of sympathetic magic, which means the appearance of an object resembles the cure it is believed to offer. Later on, I'll show some examples of this. And by their prophylactic role in warding off disease, evil, and bringing about good luck and harmony, amulets are believed, therefore, to be endowed with magical power. People believe in amulets because they're important in their lives. They shape their attitudes, spirituality, well-being, even life and death. Amulets are assumed to be efficacious either when they're touched, held, or kept close against the body. As such, they've been referred to as objects of solace, because they've been invested with hopes or beliefs that somehow they mediate on behalf of the owner. So amulets have a twofold role for their owners, therefore. They're familiar to them, but also because they're highly individual, they're also peculiar to them. Many charms have been made in the process accompanied by magical rituals, and the potency of the charm, therefore, is reinforced by ritualistic processes. And people believe in charms because these magical objects are embodiments of the anxieties felt about human frailties. They have the assumed power of drawing on the dark arts, superstition and magic. But the properties of charms, though, are not necessarily those of amulets. Charms, unlike amulets, can transfer their effects across distances. Charm only acts in ways specified by tradition, and its effects are limited and defined, for as a charm is worn in order to avert misfortune, some objects are neither amulets nor charms, but objects used in ritual or instilled with a supernatural power. Hole stones are stones with natural holes in them, which formerly believed to have magical powers of various kinds. These stones are found in many places as standing stones, small perforated pebbles, or as large hole rocks. There's a widespread belief in the magic properties of naturally holed stones, some of which are called hagstones or witch's stones. Prehistoric man, we know, attached magical properties to fossils. The small holed stones carried in the pocket were thought to protect against witchcraft. There are many names. Some are known as hagstones, holy stones or holy stones, dobby stones, adder stones, and in Scotland they are referred to as mare stones, wish stones, nightmare stones and witch riding stones. The superstition concerning nightmares believe a hold stone at the bed's head. You put it at the end of your bed during the night, it prevents the nightmare, and it's called a hag stone. But hags were supposed to turn up during the night and give you your nightmares. The hold stones were in Europe regarded as prophylactics, therefore, for bad dreams and nightmares. They're also regarded as magical as early as the beginning of the 2nd millennium BC. Perforated stone amulets were seen as hostile to the crafts of witches and protective against the evil eye. Upper Paleolithic groups in southern France, when they came across fossil echinoids, which are fossil sea urchins, they found them while they were flint working, and they used them, used the regular shaped ones, which are known biologically to us now as Sigaris and Diadema. They regarded them as magical objects, and this was also regarded as magical by the Celtic peoples thousands of years later. Pliny the Elder, as I mentioned before, he related a story of an object called a snake egg, which was used by Druids and is known as Ovum Manguinum, and that was invested with great magical powers. One naturalist philosopher, he valued sea urchins as an antidote to poison. His name was Boot, which is 1609. Fossil echinoids, these sea urchins, from Dolmy, Vestonice in Czechoslovakia, they came to be known as dew stones. Their shape suggesting usefulness in treating urethral and bladder troubles according to sympathetic magic treating like. Another state of the bodies called Tekelisi by Pliny, Lepidus Duodeci and Syriaci. They were celebrated by ancient physicians for their diuretic properties. And this carried on, this belief lasted for more than 3 millennia, using dew stones as talismans. The earliest record of uses was in ancient Greece during the 24th dynasty, around 650 BC. In Denmark, numerous fossil urchins have been found that were used as amuletic pendants during the earliest centuries AD. And the use of hole stones was very, very common. Some phones were known as holy volutes, and similar to hold or holy, the mention is hold or holy. They often confuse the whole with the term holy. The amuletic use of such stones, in other words, they're using a mystical remedy. The belief in the magic of a hold stone was not its substance, not the stone itself, but its perforation. It's the hole that had the pendant properties. And this was what it bestowed its value. In Oriental snake stones, which ones you see have marbled markings, they were used as protection against snakes. They were called Draconitis or Draconita lapis because they resembled the skin of a snake, like treating like. And the forms of beads, depending upon religious and magical beliefs, is a generally accepted opinion. What a lot of people don't realise is that beads can be seen with a serial assemblage of lots of tiny hole stones. Another quick piece is touch pieces. Probably all heard of touch pieces. Well, they're coins and medallions. They're attached to superstitious beliefs, and they're known as touch pieces because they're believed to have a prophylactic property to cure ailments and disease. The commonality is in their name, and to be effective they have to be touched, they have to be in close contact. Only in this manner can the permanent magic power contained in the coin be transferred to the person to be treated. Once done, the touch piece effectively becomes an amulet.
Eric Edwards makes us familiar with the definition of the amulet as an object of solace that confers protection by its sole presence. These are his words. Believers in amulets embrace the belief that the external world can be changed by man's subjective attitude to it. And they externalize this attitude in objects such as stones, medallions, and the like. Similarity and contagion are the principles of sympathetic magic, says Eric Edwards, as he quotes Sir James George Frazer. The amuletic properties appear to belong to objects that bear similarities with the forms or the imagined forms of the afflictions they are meant to prevent or heal, or with the forms of symbols of veneration, such as crosses, stars, spheres, or natural beings. At some point in the lecture, later on, we are reminded of some notable cases of amuletic prophylaxis and homeopathic magic, with such curious examples as the stolen potato carried in the pocket as a cure for rheumatism. I imagine that if each one of us became ready to steal a potato from the supermarket as to protect oneself against, let's say, joint pain, a total revolution will be only a few steps away. Maybe Georges Bataille would have approved of such an unorthodox rebellion, but, dear listeners, don't take the example as an invitation. Frazer's law of contagion explains that amulets need proximity for the production of their expected effects. Hanging from a little chain, carried in one pocket or played with by an anxious hand, placed upon the belly of the sickly or under the bed, or on your car's windshield, a bumper sticker, a feather, a dry branch, a holy stone, witch stone, snake stone, even a sucking stone. Whether Molloy's sucking stones were amuletic or not, by the way, still remains a mystery for me. Stones in the forms of gazes, fears, and even hunger. The textures of those touch pieces narrate the vicissitudes of luck which, needless to say, remain impenetrable. Let's listen now to the second half of Eric Edwards' lecture, notably crowded with examples of homeopathic magic. It seems that stones are especially suitable to become amulets in rainy countries surrounded by dark salt water. And on the other hand, I especially admire the way Eric Edwards draws the path between popular superstitions and museum interests, explaining the residual concern manifest in times of grief and crisis of all sorts of individuals for the hypothetic power of charms and talismans. A tolerance, even an obedience, so pervasive that at some point reached to secure a place for those objects into the collector's home and finally into the museum. We'll go back to that later. Now, let's listen to the second half of The Self-Management of Misfortune by Use of Amulets and Charms by Eric Edwards. You may notice again the presence of the imaginary slideshow and also that of a hand playing with a small medallion near the voice recorder.
These are amulets and charms in the London museums. For London has retained evidence of folklore and folk life. During the 20th century, it was accepted view that magical and superstitious beliefs are really only associated with rural areas rather than cities, and this is not true. Amulets deposited in London's museums collections now form a repository that reflects the concerns and beliefs of the population of the capital. Edward Lovett, who was of the Council of the Folklore Society, mounted an exhibition of charms at Southwark Central Library in Walworth Road in 1917. And this shows how widespread were superstitious beliefs in East and South London fortunes of individuals were affected by some inanimate object deemed lucky or potent against disease. There are, and were in London, variants of a universal or national law, an example being that folk whooping cough remedies were recorded as much in London as the Midlands. Edward Lover, he was a London bank cashier. He eventually became quite important in the Bank of Scotland in London. He was an amateur folklore collector, and he amassed a trove of 1,400 amulets and charms, devoted much time and effort to collecting from market vendors, herbalists and costermongers in working class London from the 1880s onwards. His now mostly forgotten collection is scattered around London in the Wellcome Collection, the Cumming Museum in Southwark, the Science Museum and the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, where they are basically archived but rarely seen. The Wellcome Collection of Henry Salomon Wellcome between 1853 and 1936, that contains some 4,000 amulets, including dead animals and meticulously carved shells. Well, these curiosities were sold to Wellcome by Edward Lover himself, who scoured London, mainly after dark, seeking and buying from the city's mudlarks, sailors and barrowmen. And the Wellcome Museum Medical Collection was opened in 1913, 54A Wigmore Street in London, but it is now located in the Science Museum. Well, Lovett sold to Wellcome a bronchitis necklet from Bermondsey in 1940. It's a pair of dried mole strips from King's Lynn. And it's a pure treatment against rheumatism. And he also collected a small amuletic boot used on the Winchelist when it comes to Pitt River's version of these. Small amuletic boot was used by a Surrey regiment man between 1901 and 1916. And they were all displayed in what Wellcome called the Hall of Primitive Medicine after 1914. And the emphasis being on exhibiting a material culture as objects of knowledge in their own right. And this is what Wellcome and Lovett saw amulets as. They were valid artifacts that had their own right to be studied and understood. With the Edward Lovett collection, he really represented what can be described as a paradigm of middle-class respectability. He spent his working life in the City of London and rose to be chief cashier in the Bank of Scotland. Well, figure eight, that's his collection of charms. Well, as a folklore collector, he explored a very different side of the capital of England. He was president of the Croydon Natural History and Scientific Society in the 1880s. And just like the house of General Pitt Rivers, the Caterham home of Lovett was filled with this vast collection of his charms and amulets. Included, there were examples from the First World War, British soldiers who travelled to the Western Front with good luck mascots and charms. Pinning on these amulets, British Tommies, they sought protection in action, and some sewed old farthings into their braces for protection by being close to the heart. And some talismans were made from used cartridges with one bullet charm engraved frank. Well, Lovett's hoard of amulets captured something of the beliefs of everyday Londoners from a century ago. The items of his curious collection of charms were carried in the pockets of Londoners for luck and protection. Example of this is a West London medical inspector for schools informed Lovett that children wore necklaces of glass beads to ward off bronchitis. And these necklaces against bronchitis, especially the blue beads, which most of which were imported from Austria, they were never to be taken off. Potato or knuckle bone, which is an astragalus bone from a sheep, a dead bone supposedly that will absorb the affliction, and it's carried in the pocket for its efficacy. So were small sealed leather covered glass tubes containing mercury. They were carried in the pocket by sufferers. And these phials were from the pharmacist's company called Allen & Hanbury, who still was selling them in 1924 to Londoners. They were carried by many so-called city men and refugees from Belgium who were in London as a result of the First World War. They wore cat skins for rheumatism and chest complaints. Another one, a general childhood prophylactic, was a necklace of acorns around the neck. There are some examples of this in the Pitt Rees Museum. A necklet of nightshade was thought useful helping an infant cut its teeth. Whitechapel Jews employed orris root to relieve sore teeth and gums. But orris root was Iris Florentina, and it's chosen for its resemblance to a human figure. The male figure of an orris root, one that resembled the male, was used to cure the boys, and if it resembled a female, then the girls got it as a treatment. Whooping cough, or pertussis, that was used, well, it was treated in Bethnal Green in 1913 with a small scrap of child's hair. It was placed between two slices of buttered bread, and the following day was given to a dog. They threw it out the door and made for a dog to eat it, so that the dog would take away the pain. Cramp stones, they are carried in the pocket and regarded as very effective, and some sharks' teeth were sold in London street markets as a cure for cramp. A hyoid bone from the sheep's is in the throat was thought lucky against drowning and popular in a port city of London. In the north, this amulet was called Thor's Hammer. Well, we can come now to amulets and charms in Britain, even though I've mentioned some. But despite awareness of the existence of healing charms from the Middle Ages, modern academics have largely neglected this aspect of popular magic. There was a long-term interest in Anglo-Saxon and medieval charms and amulets, as well as traditions attached to them. But during the Anglo-Saxon period, including written talismans and spells as charms against fevers, ague and toothache, charms became widespread during the 18th and 19th centuries. And children's ailments appear to have been more for prevention than other branches of folk medicine. In other words, there seems to be an overriding concern for prevention in childhood, which, as we know, in those periods, a lot of children died anyway. Silver-mounted lodestone pendant was carried by a Mr. Blaine from Puddington, suspended above his stomach, carried this to avert the king's evil and to cure his fits. And the king's evil was really known as Srofula, or tuberculosis of the neck, and often the king's evil was treated with a touchstone. Well, in England itself, in general, homeopathic charms are found throughout England, where holstones figure in folk remedies. Holstones had many different names and magical uses, including repelling witchcraft, disease caused by spells, and again, the influence of the evil eye. In Cambridgeshire, holstones were put under the bed to prevent cramp. Ammonites were invested with the supernatural in the belief they were petrified snakes. So once again, the concept appears like treating like. Fossil crinoids, which are our sea urchins, also known as St. Cuthbert's beads. Well, fossil achini, these things, are also referred to as shepherd's crowns. Pneumolites, which are coiled crinoids, are referred to as fossil money or little money. You see, the geology of the Whitby area in Yorkshire has large numbers of these fossil cephalopods or ammonites, and the Whitby snake myth contains the idea that the fossils were coiled snakes petrified by St. Hilda of Whitby. And in Kensham in Bristol, which is miles away, it is believed that the Celtic virgin St. Keen turned snakes into snowman ammonites, or snake stones as they call them locally. In the west of Scotland, a child is assumed at risk from the effects of the evil eye before baptism, and as a protection, the remedy is to bathe the newborn immediately in salt water, which it then must taste three times. And for whooping cough, an anodyne necklace of beads, once again beads around the neck, is placed as a necklace. For diphtheria, a recently removed cat's fur is placed around the neck, or scratch the neck with mole's claws. And a spider in a well-sealed goose quill placed around the neck will clear a thrush. Similarly, a piece of red flannel wrapped around the neck of a child is thought to ward off disease. Red flannel is still used by people. Later on, I think they called it cernatine. In Morocco, a whooping cough is treated with a neck amulet of a camel's windpipe. And prophylactic action to prevent convulsions in childhood includes biting off the head of a live mouse and hanging it as an amulet around the child's neck. Now, I've got a little few more things to say. It's just about, really, amulets and charms in the Pitt Rivers Museum. Now, I know I've mentioned some already. The displays as a demonstration of superstitious customs. The collection of horse brasses shows objects once regarded as amulets. And with time, the original idea has been forgotten and they've degenerated into mere ornaments. The same applies to the charms and amulets comprising part of a symphonic magic display. The cast of a stone implement regarded as a thunderbolt was found in Jersey in 1897. It was built into the house to prevent it being struck by lightning. Prophylactic stones include a piece of amber carried by a fisherman from Suffolk for his rheumatism, a veined water-torn or water-worn stone from Devon was carried to cure toothache, and another stone from Devon was rubbed on warts as an example of the transfer of virtue type of charm. There's another one in the grating. And from Suffolk, a knuckle bone from a sheep was used as a cure for cramp and rheumatism. These can all be seen in the Pitt Rivers. There's a popular charm against rheumatism is carrying a potato in the pocket. And to be curative, they had to be stolen. There may be a logical explanation for such superstitious practice, because it is now known. Alan Davis wrote about it in the Pitt Rivers newsletter. The eyes of potatoes contain atropine, which reputedly is a cure for rheumatism and may justify the belief. I'm not saying that magic's true, but there's always an element there that some of it is quite sensible. Yeah, nearly done. The natural elements include a large briony root, which can be seen in the Pitt Rivers, bought in 1916 from a Headington labourer because of its resemblance to human shape, who believed it to be a mandrake and that it was magical. A child's caul, or a fetal membrane, the amnion, left in situ on an amnion infant's head. That was thought to be a good omen and a charm against drowning. It's from Oxford. One from Oxford was found in St. Ed's in 1906 and was originally part of Henry Balfour's collection. A caul, or kel, that had amuletic value for sailors and derived from the term siliho or sili holyho. And in France it's called the Etre-Nicoth, and means the person is very lucky. In Nelson's time, there was a roaring trade in Portsmouth in calls from children because they believed they wouldn't be drowned at sea. Well, children's calls belong to a group of amulets that include body parts as their representation. Similar charms include the dried tip of the human tongue, which E.B. Tyler collected, and was actually carried well before 1897 as an amulet against disease in Tunbridge Wells, though it was more usual to carry the tips of animal tongues for this purpose. Back to the ancient Egyptian. Now, this isn't in the Pitt Rivers Museum. This is a small blue amuletic figurine referred to as Ptah Sakaris. And where there is one in the Pitt Rivers Museum, it does happen to be this one. I just don't have the illustration for the Pitt Rivers one. He represents a dwarf protected god, Ptarchos. He guards the living, but he guards particularly children. And what appears to be an insignificant glazed turquoise figure is in fact a magical amulet. We see him in his cousin, Rappi. Museum amulets and charms. They're part of a matrix through time and space. They act as a social glue, and this reaffirms a vital and continuous relationship between people and objects. Objects whose meaning has changed and still changes over time. And for many people, what were once vital magical objects, they're now mere curiosities. Once belief in a charm is lost, it loses its power and it loses its meaning. Well, amulets and charms are inanimate, and they are possibly made from dead things. And the life is invested in them, even though they're dead. Life is invested in these dead objects by generations of people who believe that by doing so they could circumvent misfortune. So they use sympathetic and homeopathic magic. But I like to think that, especially having seen so many of them in the pit, that as far as these displays are concerned, these folklore beliefs, they spread far beyond the locus of the museum. In this context, I think that amulets and charms are the result of strategies and the active participation in creating and welding social relations. I think we're getting into some aspects of material culture here, but I hope so. Yeah. And basically, some people may detect tension between modernity and the display of magic artifacts in museum collections. Well, nevertheless, museum displayed amulets and charms, despite modernity as far as I'm concerned, still exert their magic through wonder, curiosity, and for some, a continuing belief. Okay.
Thank you, yes.
It doesn't seem accidental that one of the main amulet collectors Mr. Edwards speaks about was also a bank cashier. Is the collector of amulets aiming to seize luck? We may think his intention is as fetishistic as it is analytical. In a way, the collection imprisons the amulet inside the crystal of its own fable, mummifying its powers. The withholding gesture of the collector is one of emergency, for everything is disappearing as fast as everything is multiplying. I recently heard the curious story of an Italian collector that was incapable of detaching a painting from his lounge wall by fear of the house collapsing as soon as the object was removed. Can anything become an amulet? The reply is yes. Can an amulet also forget its own history and go back to the secular life? Of course. Of course, this is all quite ironic. The demise of superstition may be proven by the fact that no museum robbery has the purpose of appropriating magical objects for their supernatural powers. However, that does not make the power of ancient and even modern artworks less metaphysical. We may even say with some humor that they are as metaphysical as they are metaphysical. However, the amulet seems to supplement the power of money over life. The desires placed on amulets and charms are attempts to patch the gap separating human powers, or the wealth to buy them, from the intrinsic human frailties. In this sense, precious and humble amulets are equal in scope and power. Material does not make them different. It is rather a matter of origin, of belonging. Precious or humble, their dignity does not pertain to the realm of the merchandise, although it may appear as a projection of it. Amulets are in fact the aristocracy of things without value. That is their abstract feature. In that sense, we started saying that they are conceptual objects. The amulet originates in existential poverty, in lack, and thus appears in the world of merchandise as an ambassador of the land of things without value. Amulets may be found anywhere, but their homeland is lack and barbaric poverty. Lucky those who saw the birth of an amulet, as Eric Edwards narrates, the metamorphosis of pebble into medallion. Amulets don't originate in the world of merchandise, but somewhere behind the projection screen of poverty and barbarism. Lost amongst merchandise, amulets are always found. They are residual. We welcome them as positive manifestations of the uncanny thingness of merchandise that market value fails to define. They are carriers of that thingness, receptacles of our nostalgia for the world of things unmediated, one that we pair with the animist vision and our phantasms about the wild soul, the primitive, the barbaric, and so on. In between those two poles, those two spheres, the civilized present, the mythical past of the wild soul, etc., we discover the liminal role of the rural world, and more exactly, the rural lower classes. Meanwhile, unaware of genealogy, the hand holds the amulet as a key or compass in her unfruitful journey toward destiny and the real. The existence of the amulet is mapped onto a metaphysical scheme, far from which the amulet is a mere stone. This said, the fetishism of merchandise and the fetishism of amulets are not opposed, and even less, they are incompatible. What Pier Paolo Pasolini called the anarchy of power, l'anarchia del potere, manifests for us as the anarchy of capitalism and the anarchy of animism mirror each other. The amulet speaks allegorically of both the lost world of things and the unfulfilled promises of the merchandise. But I will not forget either that Eric Edwards finishes his lecture with a reference to the tension between modernity and the display of magical objects in a museum. Those are his words, pointing obliquely at the museum space as the repository of modern culture. It does not seem an accident that amulets, artworks, and historical relics coexist in museums, for amulets, artworks, and relics are equally instrumental in the perpetual re-elaboration of the myth of value. And so, while we take part in that endless re-elaboration, and as we visit one museum after the other, in order to scrutinize their forms and importance, those mysterious objects readily act at the service of their sponsors. By now, you may be wondering whether this program is not just an odd prologue to Luis Buñuel's film Viridiana. I'm not sure myself. Thank you once again for listening, and remember that radio is the perfect hideout from the evil eye.
40 cartones pintados con palos de ensueño, de engaño y de amor. La vida es un mazo marcado, baraja los naipes. La mano de Dios, las malas que embosca la villa, se dieron en juego en cada ilusión. Y así fue robándome fichas la carta negada de tu corazón. Hagan juego, monte criollo, que en su emboque tu ternura palpite. Hagan juego.
Out the club about three, to the takeaway. The shit in a tray merchants. Shop's got a special perchant for the disorderly. Geezers looking ordinary and a few looking leery. Chips fly round to the sound of the latest chart entry. An incendiary, waiting to blast. No arm with a contest, who can throw the furthest?